very much. And Linda, thanks for, how much notice did you have on that?
Last night, and I haven't played in 6 years.
Last night, what? thank all of you for as usual, the very richness that you bring to our Sunday services. There are certain passages, reflections, meditations, and the like that I find myself returning to, I find myself returning to over the years, because as familiar as the words may become to me, the message remains as fresh and new as ever. One such piece, which I have probably used on other occasions at this time of year for one reason or another, is by a now long retired Unitarian Universalist minister named Clark Dewey Wells, who wrote a little meditation many, many years ago now called The Nicest Gifts I Ever Got. It's a personal piece, but it also speaks in a universal way about the nature and meaning of giving. And this is what he wrote. I better just keep this up here because I'm probably going to need it from time to time. During this season of giving, a good exercise is to make a list of the best gifts we ever got. That will tell us what's important for ourselves and for the people we want to give gifts to. While I remember a Daniel Boone hat and a magician set with special affection, the nicest gifts I ever got are in another category. The Carol Rainier at Rockefeller Chapel, who let me strike one of the largest tune bells in the world during his playing of Ein Festeberg. My mother giving me a complete set of Shakespeare for my 14th birthday. Coach Al Terry saying, "Little Wills, grab your helmet," and permitted me to enter as a freshman into my first varsity football game. A beautiful lady on a ship when I was still an acne teenager who kissed my face and told me she thought I was handsome. Dr. Henry Nelson Wyman telling me he thought for several hours about a question I had raised in class and responding with a written answer the next day in front of the whole class. Night after night, my father playing catch with me in the backyard until it got so dark we couldn't see the ball. A Unitarian minister in Kalamazoo who put his arm around me after my father died and kept it there for a long time. A friend who flew several hundred miles to visit me when I was sick. A buddy who went to see three movies with me on the same day. The nicest gifts people have given me have been enabling, confirming gifts, bestowing understanding and self-esteem, help in time of trouble, and delight to ordinary days. Clark then concludes, "May I suggest that you too draw up your list of the nicest gifts you ever received. I think it will give some perspective to the kind of gifts we really want to give to others this Christmas and holiday season, or any time." Well, part of me would just as soon stop talking right now and let each of you draw up the list that Reverend Wells suggests. But I've got a few more bases to touch in what will basically be kind of an extended meditation on giving, playing off of some of these words this morning. Not that I need to tell you this, but we are in the full rush now of a season which, for all of the many and varied ways observed and celebrated, has gift-giving as one of its hallmarks. This year, and I hardly need to tell you this either, many of you know this up close and personal, the season comes at a time of an economic crisis such as our country has not seen in decades. This creates a kind of compound anxiety. First of all, am I getting the, quote, right gifts for the people to whom I wish to give or who are expecting me to give to them? And can I afford it all this year? I also know the current economic climate is not affecting all of us in the exact same way. For some of us, it does present a challenge, does present a burden. Others of us are relatively unscathed. That's why I decided I would not make an attempt at a one-size-fits-all sermon meditation with some kind of a title like A Guide to Holiday Shopping in Tough Economic Times. I don't mean to make light of a subject that's a serious concern for a lot of people. I'm just not quite sure what I would say on that topic by myself. I hope if you need that, you can find that information. What I'm going to suggest instead, and you could consider this a gift to yourself, is to set aside some small portion of time, either alone or with someone, some of those who are the closest to you, and compose your own version sometime over the next week or so of Clark Wells Meditation. You don't have to write it down if you don't want to, but see what you come up with in recalling for yourself the nicest gifts I ever got. I will let you in on a few things that I came up with when I did this exercise for myself. Since I believe in leading by example, here's three things that I came up with. In addition to their providing me with a secure and loving home environment when I was growing up, in what in our home seemed like a perpetual economic crisis, the greatest gift my parents gave me was the sacrifices they made and the corners they cut to help me to go to college. Kind of a side note on this, as I look at what is involved in going to college now, I consider myself fortunate that I was able to go to college at a time when a working class family could actually afford or help afford to send someone there. But for all the years that I have logged and all the changes my life has gone through since I graduated college, I can still say that those 4 years were the singularly most transformative ones for me in terms of where my thinking and my worldview was when I entered college and where it was when I left, to the point that my dear parents wonder if they'd done the right thing in sending me off to begin with in the first place. Well, they did. And theirs was a gift that has served me well to this day. Another such gift, which he didn't even know he was giving, came from the Reverend Max Gabler, Madison, Wisconsin. Max, like Clark, is now long into his retirement from the UU ministry. In the fall of 1977, I moved to Madison from a little town where I've been living a ways north of there to prepare for a second career for myself at the University of Wisconsin. This was after I had left the mainline Protestant Christian ministry. And Max, whom I'd only met in passing a few times, he called me up right after I got to town and offered me a job, small part-time job, but one that I needed nonetheless, a job running a student campus ministry program out of the First Unitarian Society of Madison. And being around that congregation during the 1977-78 academic year, being around that congregation, getting to know and confide in Max, allowed me to see that I really wasn't done with the ministry after all. I just needed another venue for it. That venue was called, and is called, continues to be called, Unitarian Universalism. So Max's gift, that one little phone call, is one that has certainly served me very well up to this day. Backing up a little bit, but still with the present very much in mind, another enduring gift I got was in theological school, when I linked up with three other guys who have become my lifelong soulmates. In fact, we all have for one another. You know, some of the stuff that we did during those days are things I still, for whatever crazy reason, and maybe if you've got children or not children or no longer children, you can relate to this, I don't know, but some of the stuff that we did, I still can't bring myself to tell my son about. And he is older now than we were then. Anyway, out of all that late 1960s craziness, which was a wonderful kind of craziness for the most part, came a bond that has stood the four of us in good stead in all the years that have followed. It has been a gift to know that some of the very highest and some of the very lowest points of my life in all those 40 years since we met, I know these guys can say the same. It's really a gift to know that there's a core circle of people, wherever they happen to be in the world, that you can turn to at those times. And as the four of us now have moved into the sixth decade of our lives, we have come to make it a point to get together one weekend every summer. It's a good way to remind ourselves that the gift endures, and it is one that has served me well to this day. Well, that's my partial list, and that's as far as I'm going to go with it. As I say, I offer it to you this morning as an invitation for you to do some kind of thinking, reflecting, meditating of your own on that subject. A little present I got for myself this past week, to shift gears for a bit, I was caught by the title of it. It was called The Power of Giving, a book here called The Power of Giving, How Giving Back Enriches Us All, by a couple of guys named Azim, A-Z-I-M, Azim Jamal, and Harvey McKinnon. That was an interesting combination of names, Azim and Harvey. A Middle East guy and an Irish guy. They put together this book, and they both have careers apparently as fundraisers for nonprofits and being motivational speakers and all those other kinds of things like that that they do, and so they decided to write a book based on their experiences. I can't say this is something that'll blow your socks off, at least it didn't do mine, but it's got some good little nuggets in it here and there if you can go and mine them out, and I'm going to briefly hold up one that I found as I read it over this past week. In a chapter titled, Why Give?, the two authors put out Abraham Maslow's familiar sort of pyramid hierarchy of needs, to which I think I very briefly referred last week. Many of you are familiar with this. I think they've become sort of a basic staple of most Psych 101 classes and wherever else it gets discussed. So you probably know Maslow uses this pyramid to illustrate his typology, and at the base of his pyramid are such fundamental human needs that you got to have to survive, your physiological ones, you know, what you need for physical survival. And then you got your security needs, which are having a reasonably safe place to operate from as you go about your day-to-day businesses. Those two things have to be in place before you can continue to move along. I didn't realize when I wrote this, but from all the hands that went up, and we're just still getting our house back to warm ourselves back home, it's kind of interesting what happens when you get driven back to those first two basic needs, which is what has happened to a lot of us over these past few days. You probably didn't spend, if you were in a home that had no power and you're wondering how you're going to keep warm or heat up some food to eat and all of that, you probably weren't reflecting too much on the meaning of life or anything like that. I know I certainly wasn't. Well, anyway, once you've got those foundational building blocks reasonably well in place, even though sometimes we get knocked back down to them once in a while, even though you've got those building blocks reasonably well in place, it is then that you can move along to attending to what Maslow called self-actualization or spiritual needs, which is another way of saying the need for some kind of overarching, transcendent meaning to one's life, for some sense of happiness and contentment or acceptance that you can still maintain, even in the midst of the setbacks and the disappointments that will inevitably come your way. Well, Azim and Harvey's take on Maslow is that once you've managed to take care of yourself or acquire for yourself those base of the pyramid needs, the way you move on up beyond them is by finding or choosing ways of giving yourself over to something greater than yourself. You've got to kind of take in what you need at the base of the pyramid, but then they say as they move on up, you got to figure out, if you're going to get there, you got to think about and come up with ways of giving it back. They put it in a rather simple and straightforward way. All people want to achieve meaning, fulfillment, and happiness. However, thousands of years of human history confirm that these things come not from being self-centered, but from making a difference and giving happiness to others. The way you find yourself, that is to say, is to get over yourself. Actually, a very wise Jewish prophet and teacher, whose birth gets celebrated at this time of year, said the same thing when he said, whoever will lose his or her life will find it. Well, losing your life, as I read this admonition, doesn't mean dissolving your ego, since that's kind of impossible to do anyway. It really means deciding for yourself what is worth giving yourself over for. So I would let that be the corollary to that seasonal exercise I suggested earlier. Once you have identified the nicest or most meaningful and lasting gifts you have ever received, then see where that might take you in determining what you feel is the most worthy, even the most demanding of what you now wish to give to others. I want to interject here. I alluded to this earlier when I introduced the outreach collections. I want to interject here my own note of seasonal gratitude to you as a congregation today. We, that is to say our governing board and I, we have to make a pretty strong case for your support every year to keep the operations of this church adequately funded. And we'll be at it again sometime after the first of the year when another pledge drive comes around. But what gives me hope and courage, knowing again that many of you are facing tough times right now? What gives me hope and courage when I think on such matters as these, as you and I and all of us have to do, is your generosity in giving to those things that go beyond our congregational needs by way of our outreach collections. Our latest round of these collections, which we are still continuing through this month, has been to help out area families in need of a warm home this winter through the fuel assistance program, as we said, of Southern New Hampshire Services. Your donations have exceeded, not counting this Sunday, $4,100 so far, and we're running this collection through the end of this month. Back to this weekend again. Many of you, we are still without power in your homes. I said we got ours back sometime last night. And to just not have a cold home for a day or two is difficult enough. To think of that as being an ongoing concern throughout the New England winter is kind of painful for me to think about, just because the last couple of days themselves were pretty tough, as they continue to be for a lot of you guys. I'd say one way we find ourselves as a liberal religious community does lie in what we give away. Staying with that for just a moment, we've not done this before. For the first time for everything, we are going to have a time in our Christmas Eve services where we will do our part to match the gift of an anonymous donor to our local soup kitchen and shelter. This has been in the papers over the past few weeks. Someone offered to match gifts. Someone who wanted to remain anonymous has offered to match gifts of up to $500,000 for whatever the shelter can receive by the end of this year of 2008. And I believe they're about halfway there to matching that amount. We want to be one of those donors that helps them get to their goal. And so I hope you will come prepared to share the spirit of giving in this season. If you'll be joining us on Christmas Eve. If not, you can certainly contribute to the church anyway. Thank you again for your generous and giving spirit as a congregation. I started this service off with a reading, or this sermon off with a reading from a ministerial colleague. And I'm going to end it with a story from another one. This one is one of the many books that Reverend Forrest Church has published over the course of his lifetime. This one is called Everyday Miracles. He came out with it quite some time ago. I did a sermon on Forrest's latest and most likely his last book earlier this fall when I did a sermon called Love and Death. I'm sure Forrest would tell you that the greatest gift he has received in this Christmas holiday season is that he is here to celebrate it, given the dire cancer diagnosis he was given a little less than a year ago. It really wasn't even supposed to bring him into this season. Well, this is a story that he wrote many years ago as a meditation on his grandfather, as well as a meditation on giving. It's called The Richest Man in the World. It runs on for a little bit, so I'm going to just kind of settle back and let me read you a story here for a few minutes. My grandfather was the richest man in the world. I know this because whenever I visited his home, he would slip me a $5 bill. Spend on anything you want, he'd say, but don't tell your parents. I remember Chase Clark as a short man with twinkling eyes and a shock of white hair. When he was 2, his family moved to Idaho from Indiana. 60 years later, the people of Idaho elected him governor. But that isn't what made him special. A self-educated lawyer who specialized in everything from shotgun weddings to moonshine, he brought all his clients new boots so that if they went to jail, they wouldn't catch cold. My grandparents lost one child, but when my grandmother got pregnant again, Chase Clark, concerned for her health, closed his law practice and they moved to Salt Lake City. For the next 6 months, they waited together for my mother to be born. His practice didn't suffer, neither did his pocketbook. Having accepted land in lieu of fees, he owned tens of thousands of acres, many of them in the area that is now Sun Valley. At the time of the first great Wall Street crash, Chase Clark was a member of the board of the largest bank in the area. The bank folded as a casualty of the Depression, keeping only his ranch and sold all his land at dirt prices, personally making good on every small investor's holding. In 1940, he was elected governor, but was defeated in the election of 1942. Early that year, a Catholic priest went to him, pleading for action to redress the growing problem of overcrowding at the state penitentiary. There were nearly three times as many prisoners in the penitentiary that the penitentiary was built to hold. Murderers were sharing cells with pickpockets. Within 3 months of election day, my grandfather pardoned more than 100 prisoners. Only two ever returned behind bars. Several showed up at his funeral in 1966. But the issue for which his opponents had been praying presented itself. Having been convinced that it was no longer safe to walk the streets at night, the voters turned against Chase Clark, and he lost by 200 votes. My grandfather died when I was in my first year at college, but it wasn't until much later my parents told me something about him that truly startled me. The richest man in the world left almost nothing in his will. At first, my parents couldn't understand this, but then they looked through his books. For years, at the end of each month, he cleaned out his accounts. $50 there, $20 there, $50 here, $20 there. Everything he didn't need for food or mortgage payments, he gave away to good causes and derelict relatives. Now I know why. To my delight as a child, his desk drawers were chock full of trinkets. Some boys club in Omaha would send him a plastic American flag lapel and he would respond with a check. And every Christmas morning, as each of us took turns unwrapping his lavish gifts and then telling him he shouldn't have gone overboard the way he did, he'd simply reply, "You can't take it with you." I had a poor relative too. The only time she ever took us out to dinner, she left her purse at home. Intelligent and strong, she lived simply in a tiny duplex apartment. When I graduated from high school, she gave me a $50 savings bond. That was 20 years ago, which means I can finally cash it in for its full face value if only I knew where it was. But I didn't mind. She was poor. And anyway, my rich grandfather gave me a car when I graduated. Who could ask for more? What I didn't know over the years is that my poor relative had shrewdly amassed a small fortune. She spent her life roosting on a golden egg, which hatched when she died. So I had it wrong when I was a little boy, but only partly wrong. For in the only way that it matters, my grandfather far surpassed her in riches. After all, he knew that our true wealth is measured by not what we leave behind, but by what we can afford to give away before we go. Just go one more round with that last line. Our true wealth is measured not by what we leave behind, but by what we can afford to give away before we go. Let that be one of your guiding maxims as you think on the meaning of giving in this season of giving. We cannot avoid being aware of what it is we can afford, but I hope we can keep those very necessary thoughts in some kind of a wise perspective by also thinking about all that we can afford to give away. On that note, let's sing our closing hymn. Number 404, what gift can we bring?